From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, one of soul music's most enduring voices, Gladys Knight. She recorded her first hit, Every Beat of My Heart, when she was still in high school. Her hits with Motown included I Heard It Through the Grapevine, Neither One of Us, and The End of Our Road. She had one of her biggest hits after leaving Motown, Midnight Train to Georgia. Also, world music critic Milo Miles looks behind the Macarena craze. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corva Coleman. Hurricane Hortense is just off the Dominican Republic. It already crossed over Puerto Rico, creating great damage. Puerto Rico's governor says 90% of the island residents don't have power or drinking water. Meanwhile, Hortense continues its northwesterly path toward the Bahamas. Mike Hopkins is a forecaster with the National Hurricane Center. He says Hortense's greatest danger is in rainfall.
The big problem with the storm so far has been the rainfall. We've had unofficial reports of up to 15 inches of rain over some of the elevated parts of Puerto Rico, and that seems to be the problem right now, heavy rains and with it the threat of flooding and mudslides.
Two people have died in storm-related accidents. One of those persons died in a mudslide. ValueJet is asking the government for quick final approval to fly again. ValueJet has answered a complaint from the flight attendants union. The carrier was grounded in June after a crash in May in the Florida Everglades that killed 110 people. Joshua Leves of member station WABE reports.
7 workdays have passed since the Department of Transportation gave ValueJet Airlines preliminary approval to resume business. Federal officials offered the public 1 week to present concerns about ValueJet before it would issue final approval, but the seriousness of one complaint may cause a further delay. The Association of Flight Attendants claims that ValueJet's leaders have not focused on security and cannot be trusted to run an airline. The union has called for the removal of ValueJet President Louis Jordan and CEO Robert Priddy. Fearing an extended delay, ValueJet responded late yesterday. They filed papers to the Department of Transportation asserting that the union's objections are groundless and pointing out that many flight attendants hope ValueJet will take off again soon. For National Public Radio, I'm Joshua Leves in Atlanta.
Voters in New Hampshire head to the polls today for the state's primary election. At stake are party nominations for the governor's office, a U.S. Senate seat, and New Hampshire's 2 seats in the U.S. House. From New Hampshire Public Radio, Doug McPherson reports.
Republican U.S. Congressman Bill Zeliff, an ally of House Speaker Newt Gingrich, gave up a sure re-election bid to enter a free-for-all Republican race to succeed Governor Steve Merrill. Zeliff faces stiff competition from State School Board Chairman Ovid Lamontagne, who claims to be Merrill's GOP conservative heir. Meanwhile, a recent poll shows Democratic primary favorite Jean Shaheen could defeat either Republican in November to become the state's first elected woman governor. 2 Democrats are vying to oppose incumbent Republican U.S. Senator Bob Smith, and in one of 2 congressional races, the son of former White House Chief of Staff John Sununu enjoys a narrow lead over a former television news director and the mayor of Manchester. For National Public Radio, I'm Doug McPherson in Concord, New Hampshire.
On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrial Average is down more than 3 points at 5,729. Trading is moderate. This is NPR. Thousands of firefighters in the West have been sent home as the wildfire season winds down. But federal officials are warning the threat of serious fires remains. NPR's Howard Berkus reports from Salt Lake City.
The demobilized firefighters include the Army and Marine troops enlisted to fight blazes in California. Today, about 6,000 firefighters work to control 5 major fires in Oregon, Montana, and Wyoming. That's down from a peak this year of 22,000 firefighters and 50 major fires in 8 states. Officials at the National Interagency Fire Center say conditions are still ripe for wildfire in most of the West. The fire threat, they say, will be moderate to severe region-wide for another month. Fire danger is listed as extreme in California, Oregon, and Nevada. 1996 is already one of the busiest fire seasons in 30 years. Close to 6 million acres burned. Idaho, Wyoming, and Utah were hit the hardest. I'm Howard Berkus in Salt Lake City.
Prosecutors in Oklahoma City, or rather in the Oklahoma City bombing trial, have received a legal victory. Federal Judge Richard Mache says prosecutors can win convictions and death sentences against suspects Timothy McVeigh and Terry Nichols without proving that they intended to kill. The defense argued that intent to kill must be proven in the three counts of the indictment that are related to the use of a weapon of mass destruction. The United Nations General Assembly is opening debate today on the International Nuclear Test Ban Treaty. The document would end nuclear test explosions forever, but it may never be adopted. The ban has the support of all five declared nuclear powers, the United States, Russia, France, Britain, and China, but it does not have the support of India and Pakistan. Both say that they will not sign unless the other does. Both nations are longtime foes. If they don't sign, the test ban treaty cannot become international law. I'm Corva Coleman in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Today we present an onstage interview with the great soul singer Gladys Knight.
Ooh, gotta get away from you fast as I can. Too much for me, baby, more than my heart can stand. Like a kid behind the wheel, you've been reckless with my heart. If I stay around, you'll surely tear it all apart. Saying the road's got to end somewhere. Give you the lowdown. We've come to the end of our road.
Gladys Knight recorded her first hit, Every Beat of My Heart, in 1961 when she was still in high school. In 1966, she started her 8-year stay at Motown, where her hits included The End of Our Road, I Heard It Through the Grapevine, If I Were Your Woman, and Neither One of Us. In the mid-70s, she sang deeply affecting adult ballads like Midnight Train to Georgia and You're the Best Thing That Ever Happened to Me. She sang on the AIDS anthem of the 80s, That's What Friends Are For. She's perhaps the only performer in Motown history who had hits before joining the label and after leaving it. This year, she was inducted into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. Our interview was recorded earlier this year at the Masonic Auditorium in San Francisco as part of the 15th anniversary celebration of City Arts and Lectures, which presents onstage conversations with leading figures in literature, criticism, and the performing arts.
What a house. Hey.
Gladys Knight, congratulations.
Thank you so very, very much.
Now, since you started your career as a child, I want to start our interview in your childhood.
Okay.
Now, you started singing in church, I guess, when you were 4 years old?
Yes.
What was the church like, and what did you sing?
My mom and dad had created with the church family a recital for me, and at the time we weren't being so typecast in music as sometimes we are today. So I sang a variety of things. I did songs like Ave Maria and Bless This House, and in the pop category I did Because of You and Be My Love and Too Young, and the spiritual category I did things like Go Down Moses and Swing Low Sweet Chariot. So I got to do all kinds of songs and I loved it.
Now, all your biographies say that when you were 7, you won first place on Ted Mack's original Amateur
Yes,
Hour,
I did.
Which I think of as the starfish of the past, right?
Now, that was quite an experience.
Well, whose idea was it for you to do the show?
Well, that was also my mom. That was also my mom. My mom did not believe, as other members in our families, about, you know, idle minds. They just wanted to keep us busy. It was not so much about creating an avenue or getting us prepped for show business. It was just about keeping us busy, doing ballet or doing gymnastics or whatever it was that we could do. And you know, that's really how we all came to.
So were you good? Did you think, I'm great, I'm gonna win, I've nailed this? Did you think you were good?
Nah.
Stage fright? Did you have stage fright? Were you afraid to perform, or was it easy?
No, I wasn't. It really was heavenly. My mom wrote to them and asked them if I could be on the show and if I would get an audition with them. And they wrote her back and said, yes, we would love to have her come. So we went to New York and we auditioned for them, and we got to be right on the show. And it was quite an experience because I'd never been to New York before, and I'd definitely never been on television before.
Really?
And the whole idea was really exciting, but it wasn't so much that I was getting wiped out by it. You know what I loved most?
What?
Getting made up. I mean, the lipstick was the bomb, I'm telling you. It was really great. I mean, I spent most of my time in the makeup room. So whatever they wanted, little Gladys is what they used to call me. They would send somebody up to makeup, you know, and Mr. Mack used to come up and tease us and do all of those things. They knew exactly where to find me.
What'd you do with the $2,000 you won?
My mom actually put it in a savings account for us. And after I got older and needed to do certain things, like I was singing very early, and if I wanted a new dress, which I did quite often, you know, well, she would pinch a little bit off of it, you know, and I had this little secondhand store that I had found, and I would go downtown after I got old enough to go ride the bus downtown, and I would go down to this little secondhand store, and they really had nice clothes, and my mom just taught us how to be innovative with our dress, you know, and that kind of thing, so.
Now, I believe that Gladys Knight and the Pips got started at your brother Bubba's 9th birthday party, is that right?
Yes, yes.
So what happened? You just spontaneously started singing together? What happened?
Well, yeah. Well what actually happened was we gave Bubba a surprise birthday party. My friends and I, okay? They were up on the playground playing basketball, and my friends and I got together and said, oh, it's Bubba's birthday today, so let's do something. Now, in those days, the house party was the thing, okay? You get you about 50 cent worth of bologna. And about 6 loaves of bread and some mayonnaise, make some sandwiches and cut them up real little so people think they're getting a lot, you know? And we would make sandwiches and our national drink was Kool-Aid, okay? You can make a whole lot of Kool-Aid for a nickel, you know? So we decided we were gonna have this party. But while they were up there and getting everything together, we realized that we didn't have a record player. So we set out to find some music for the party. And a friend of ours that lived around the corner from us, named Garfield, we asked him, could we use his record player? And he said yes. And we started the party. We were having a wonderful time. And Garfield was an only child, if that may speak to anything, okay? So Garfield not only wanted to control the record player, he wanted to tell everybody what to play. And we weren't in that mood that Garfield was in. So we kept telling Garfield, we don't want to hear that. We want to hear this. So he got mad. He said, you know what? I'll take my record player home. So we said, okay. And in those days, children were still into, in my opinion, using their imagination. I did a song about that, I think. they were into using their imagination. And we said, okay, music's gone. What do you want to do? So we said, let's have a talent show. So that's exactly what we did. Everybody at the party kind of got off in groups and said, oh, I want to sing. Said, oh, I'm going to dance. Oh, I'm going to tell a joke. I'm going to do. So that's how we did. And we were all part of the same choir, my family and I. Mm-hmm. So we got up and we said, okay, we're going to sing. We're going to sing together. And that was our first time singing together.
Tell me two songs the first time you sang together.
First time we sang together, we did In the Still of the Night, Canadian Sunset, other songs like that, you know, whatever was most popular at the time, and things that were before our time as well.
But then you actually started performing, right, and going on the road?
Yeah, we did. Well, we did it locally for quite a while, and it was quite unique the way the people of Atlanta supported us, because we were a church-going family, and we had afternoon programs. Matter of fact, we were that church era where you'd go in the morning, you'd come back that night. Well, you know, first you have Sunday school, then you have regular church, then you have BTU, then you have all of those things. So, you know, so when we started singing, we started doing local dates, and we kind of had the approval because we were the little group, so to speak, and they would come to church and hear us sing that morning, and then all the people that were in church would go to the club and hear us sing that night.
Now, when you started singing clubs and then even traveling around a little bit,
yes.
What did your mother try to do? What did your mother try to do to make sure that you stayed on the straight and narrow? Because you were going to be exposed to bad influences
clubs. Our parents, because all of us, see, in those days, parents still networked. You know what I'm saying? They still talked to each other. The other parents also knew what we were doing, and we knew what everybody else was doing, and everybody was allowed to chastise everybody.
Right.
Okay? So it was that kind of thing. And so once we started out on the road, it was like we took all of these things with us because there were certain things that were just not allowed. It was just not accepted.
Like what?
Like, we knew drugs would make you die, and in mm-hmm. those days, people were afraid of dying. So, well, you know. Yeah, and you know, as far as our spiritual thing is concerned, there were just certain things. You just carried yourself a certain way, and you respected your elders, and you didn't, you know, it wasn't about alcohol. That was a bad thing. And
okay, what about boys, though?
You know what? It's really weird, my life, when it comes to the personal side. By no means have I had a perfect life, but in a way, I guess because I was so tied up with the music, my personal life kind of got unbalanced, and I wasn't taken to the prom. I worked the prom.
Right,
you know?
Right.
That's right. And it was almost like with the guys, they weren't used to a working woman, you know, I guess, because nobody would approach me. And as I got, actually, to be very honest with you, I ended up getting married very early, and it was my childhood sweetheart. I was married by 17, mm-hmm. and we were starting our family. And in my opinion, 17 then was a different 17 than it is now.
Well, you must have been a very mature 17. You'd already seen so much. And
well, yeah,
so much.
I always had this thing that, you know, I was going to marry the guy. That whole scenario that we had, I was the only one in my group that was, you know,
what?
A virgin.
Oh.
You know?
I bet your mother was proud.
but it was, it, you know, that's the way it was. And so I never really got a chance to get into the men per se. Then, you know, as life would have it, my husband and I didn't end up making it all the way. And so I became a single parent early, mm-hmm. but my dad was a workaholic, so I had all of these things, even as a woman, to put in place, and having been with these guys all my life, I'd been around guys all my life. You know, I kind of begin to think like, well, you know, you do what you gotta do, kind of thing. Mm-hmm. And the Pips made sure that I did. They were very protective of me, but they were young too. So they considered me one of the boys. Right? So when we were doing things or traveling up and down the road and we had to get off the plane or get out of the car, and I said, well, you left one. It was mine. They said, well, you wanted the boys. I said, get it.
But I imagine a lot of people on the road tried to take an advantage of a young woman, to take advantage of a young woman.
Well, yeah, there were many, many stories like that. Like, and y'all got to read my book when I come out with it, too.
Oh, I hope that's soon, yeah.
But, you know, I was really, really shocked to find out that there was really such a thing as a casting couch, so to speak, mm-hmm. you know, where people really looked past your talent and looked at other ways that they could benefit by your presence or your being, you know. And I was like, what? You know?
Did the Pips protect you?
Oh, they were ferocious. They were ferocious. I'm telling you. I got to tell you this story, and it's one of the juicy ones that would be in the book, okay? But and it's a true story. We had gone to see this gentleman about doing a management situation with him. And he was a very, very heavyweight, popular young man. And at one point, they came out, they sent me out of the room. And I said, well, why do I gotta go? So they said, well, we need to talk some real heavy business. And they always kind of protected me from that. So I heard all this ruckus and stuff going on, like, you know, tables falling over and that kind of stuff. And I was sitting out in the little waiting room, you know, and I kind of said, what is going on? And they came up, come on, let's go. You know, that kind of thing. So I got up and I left, you know, and they were just steaming, you know. And I said, what is the matter? What's the matter? We didn't get the deal? I said, no. You know, they were just, so finally they told me, said, they didn't want us. They didn't want this group. They wanted you. The guy wanted you. And whatever we wanted.
Wanted you in the carnal way.
Yes.
Right.
He wanted in the carnal way. That's so nice. Yeah, yes. You know, so, you know, that was really quite something. But then as I grew up, and I was still very young then. Uh-huh. I was in my teens. And after my husband and I broke up, it was like I was a young woman by then. But no guys ever approached me wrong, so to speak, or in that way. And I started to feel like it was something wrong with me. You know, it's like, well,
maybe I'm not attractive
either. Yeah. You know, I mean, I went through that.
You probably gave off a certain strength, too, you know, that you were invulnerable and no one's going to take advantage of you.
I didn't think so because I didn't go out a lot.
Right.
You know, but those guys, and come to find out later, they were daring guys not to come near me.
We're featuring an interview with Gladys Knight, recorded at the Masonic Auditorium in San Francisco. There's more after a break. This is Fresh Air. Back to our onstage interview with singer Gladys Knight.
Now, you were, what, 17, I think, when you recorded your first hit, Every Beat of My Heart?
16.
Wow.
Yes. That was quite something, too.
Now, you had two versions that you recorded.
We had
three. Three versions. Okay. Now, the first, I believe, was recorded without you realizing that somebody was recording.
That's right.
What happened?
Well, we were performing at this club called the Builders Club in Atlanta, and we did weekends there. While we were in school, and the gentleman that owned the club came to us one night, and we were friends, and his kids went to school with us and everything. So he came to us one night, and he said, "Hey, you guys, said I got some new recording equipment in today, and we're just gonna like set up a little makeshift studio in the club tonight, and just see what kind of sounds we got. Said, would you guys mind staying over after the show?" So green as we were. We said, okay. And when we got to record that night, we did like a lot of the hit stuff, the pop stuff that was out at the time. And then he asked us if we had any original material. And we said, oh yeah, we were excited about it. We were looking forward to the day when we got a chance to record and have our first record out. And oh boy, were we ready, right? So we said, yeah, we got one thing we've really been working on. Now we weren't thinking at that time, this is not the way to do it. This is not the time that you should be protective, okay? So we did this song. The song was Every Beat of My Heart, okay? So we recorded this song, and when we knew anything, our friends at school started to telling us that we love your record.
And you didn't even know there was a record.
Yes. And they said, you got a record out. I said, is that so? Yeah. And from there, that's how we found out about it. And in the meantime, there was a scout in Atlanta looking for talent. And he had heard this song on the radio, and he asked all around town people how to get in touch with my mom. And he finally found my mom, and they came over and talked to her, and we flew to New York to sign with Bobby Robinson at Fury Records.
And the Fury Records recording became a big hit.
Right, and that's actually how we got the name Gladys Knight and the Pips, because originally we were just the Pips. And I was just one of the lead singers in the group.
Oh.
Okay. And then after we got to New York and we recorded the same song over again, Every Beat of My Heart, then Bobby Robinson suggested, why don't we name our record Gladys Knight and the Pips to distinguish between the VJ and the Hontom record, which is just the Pips. So that's how we got Gladys Knight and the Pips started, and it just kind of stuck, and it was Gladys Knight and the Pips from then on.
I have to say that this 1961 recording is an extraordinary recording. You sound so great on it.
Thank
and particularly
you.
When you think that 17 years old or 16 years old.
Yeah.
So, in fact, I think we should listen to some of this recording. Fury Records, Gladys Knight and the Pips. Let's hear it.
Oh, my goodness.
Uncomfortable to
hear
that. You
are really, really something. You know, I never really listened to myself then, because you know how you know, you feel it, that your voice is changing and you're going to crack any minute. That kind of thing. So I didn't do a lot of listening to myself during those days. I listen to myself more now. Maybe it's because I'm more into the creative end and I have to. But that sounds weird.
Gladys Knight, recorded at the Masonic Auditorium in San Francisco as part of the 15th anniversary celebration of City Arts and Lectures. We'll hear more of that interview in the second half of our show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Borders, where the love of books and music sets the standard. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, Gladys Knight talks about her years with Motown and what was world music doing at the Democratic Convention. Milo Miles looks at the Macarena craze.
I saw my love walking down the aisle, and as he passed me by, he turned to me and gave me a smile. Should have been the preacher joined their hands, and all the people
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with more of our interview with singer Gladys Knight. Before she talks about her years with Motown, let's hear her Motown hit, If I Were Your Woman.
If I were your woman and you were my man, you'd have no other woman. You'd be weak as a lamb. Strength to walk out that door, my love would overrule my sense, and I'd call you back for more. If I were your woman,
if you were my woman,
if I were your woman,
if you were my woman,
and you were my man, yeah. She tears you down, darling, says you're nothing else.
Nothing at all.
But I'll pick you up, darling.
Pick it up when you fall.
When she lets you fall, you're like a diamond.
Shining.
But she treats you like glass. Yet you beg her to love you. But me, you don't ask. If I were your woman.
If you were my woman.
If I were your woman.
Back to our onstage interview with Gladys Knight, recorded at the Masonic Auditorium in San Francisco.
Just a few years after Every Beat of My Heart, you joined Motown Records, mm-hmm. where you had some really big hits.
Yes.
Now, it's my understanding that you were the one who voted not to join Motown. when Gladys Knight and the Pips took a vote about whether to become Motown artists or not, why did you think it was a bad idea?
Well, to me, we had many years in the industry before there was a Motown.
Mm-hmm.
We knew Barry when he was a writer, you know, and as his artists came about, they would come to us, you know, for advice and try to emulate things that we were doing and those kinds of things. And as we looked more and more at Motown, to be very, very honest with you, I was afraid that we would not get the attention that we needed or deserved, even because they sort of had a caste system or more so a family system over there, and to penetrate that I felt was going to be very tough, and I didn't really want to go through that kind of thing. I preferred to go somewhere where people just, you know, mm-hmm. we didn't have to fight that. And the guys felt that all we needed, since we had our performances together, people were buying us on our show and all of that kind of thing. We had realized most of our dreams by playing the wonderful places we had aspired to play. All we needed was the national recognition that we would get from a record. And they felt like Motown was the company, definitely, out of all of them, that could achieve that for us.
Now, I've been reading Berry Gordy's autobiography, and I want to just read what he said about you. He said that the first time he saw Gladys Knight and the Pips, he was impressed by their class, artistry, and stage presence. He said, unlike many of our acts who'd been through our artist development process, Gladys and the Pips were already seasoned before coming to town. They'd actually worked with some of our key artist development people earlier in their career, including choreographer Charlie Atkins.
Uh-huh.
So you already had the equivalent of charm school. You had the choreographer
right.
working with you. How did you get into all of that? And what are some of the values? What are some of the stage values that you learned early on?
Well, that also came from my mom and our parents. They surrounded us with these kinds of people. Maurice King. Let me tell you what Barry did, too, by the way. he did like what he saw in us. And no matter what, he did always show us respect, but you needed Barry's personal touch in order to really, really rise, okay? And that's how eventually we got to getting the recognition on the records that we needed. But Barry saw us and liked everything. Do you know that he hired every single person out from under us that worked with us and started artist development? Charlie Atkins was our pops. He was our first choreographer and, so to speak, our entertainment father, because he taught us our etiquette as to what we do and what we don't do in this industry, you know, as far as teaching us how to move on stage and giving us our character and that kind of thing, along with Maurice King, who for many years had been the musical conductor and director at the famous Flame Show Bar in Detroit. So, you know, all of the people that we worked with, he was a friend of my mom, and he coached us when we were little kids, Maurice King. So he became the coach, the musical coach at Motown. So he just bought everybody that we worked with.
W- What's some of the best advice that those people gave you about either how to sing or how to carry yourself on stage?
Well, they did it really, I think, in a way, Megabucks spoiled our business. You know, it took the artistry too much out of it. We did it first for the love of it. And then the money came. Mm-hmm. And all of the things that we got into, we learned that it was just not about us. I'm elated. I am feeling at my peak when I have entertained you well. And that's what it's all about. Right? And we've lost so much of that these days, you know.
Now, I know that the Motown process was that there were meetings, I think, every Friday.
Yeah.
And the producers would come with their new songs and their little demos. Mm-hmm. And then everybody would vote on which was the record that week that was actually going to get made.
They had a lot of control in your life.
Yeah, so how did you feel as a performer? Were you in on those meetings? And did you have any say on your material or who the producer would be? What song you'd do?
No, we didn't quite have that freedom at Motown. And that was another one of my pet peeves, so to speak, you know, is that sometimes it got a little personal. Because after all, we are dealing with just human beings making these votes. So maybe that person may not have felt so good about something you did, and they're voting on something that could make or break your career, you know, and it may just go the other way. So, no, I don't like that record, you know, that kind of thing. For some personal reason, and that came to play sometimes in that arena, and it's just too important a thing to be decided that way.
No, I want you to tell the story of I Heard It Through the Grapevine, one of your great hits.
Yes.
Now, the songwriter and producer of this took it to one of the meetings, and he initially wanted Marvin Gaye to do it.
Yes.
Right? And I think Marvin Gaye was going to sing it more like a ballad.
Really?
That's what Berry Gordy says.
Uh-huh.
That's what Berry Gordy says.
Uh-huh.
I don't know. But anyways, Berry Gordy voted it down. He wanted Marvin Gaye to do a different song.
Okay.
And, right, do I have the story right?
Yes.
Okay.
I would imagine. I didn't know the Marvin Gaye story, but I know that the song had been sitting on the shelf and demoed a couple of times, just trying to see what could be done with it. Matter of fact, Barrett, who was one of the writers on the song, Barrett Strong, did it himself. And it was just kind of sitting around. So when the producer came to us with this particular song, it was like, hey, I really believe in this song, Norman Whitfield and Barrett Strong. And just take it and play with it. And we took the song with us on the road, and we were in the hotels. We'd sit out in the hall and work on our little song and stuff like that. And
can you tell us a little bit how you worked on that song, what the song sounded like before you started working on it, what you put into it that wasn't written in?
Well, we created the whole background for I Heard It Through the Grapevine. We created the whole background.
All the Oh Yes I Do
things
too.
Yeah. You go, Terry. Yep, we did the, you know, oh, yes, I am, oh, yes, I am. Don't you know that I heard it? We did all of those, all of the black background things that you heard, we did those. And what happened was we kind of broke it up. It wasn't quite put together, verse, chorus, like we ended up with it. And so we just tore it apart, put it back together. We would get up in the morning, fix our breakfast while we're planning. We would tape what we had in mind, and eventually we felt we had it right. We ran down to the studio, and we played it for Norman, and he was so excited. He just flipped. I mean, he just, hey. And Smokey happened to be in the studio. Smokey Robinson happened to be in the studio that afternoon, in Studio A, and we needed a studio because he wanted us to record it right then. And so we went upstairs, and he asked Smokey if we could borrow the studio, and Smokey said, yeah, you know. So we went on in the studio, and we recorded it right then, and it became the biggest selling record Motown had that year, and it became our first number one record. And then along came Marvin that next year. This was in 1967 for us. 1968, Marvin came out with I Heard It Through the Grapevine.
We're featuring an interview with Gladys Knight, recorded at the Masonic Auditorium in San Francisco. Now that we've heard the story of Grapevine, let's hear the record. We'll hear more from Gladys Knight after a break. This is Fresh Air. Back to our onstage interview with Gladys Knight.
Norman Whitfield and Barrett Strong, who wrote Grapevine, also wrote a lot of the Temptations songs.
Exactly.
Did you ever have to compete with the Temptations for songs?
Yeah. Matter of fact, another thing that bothered me was that when we first came to the company... When we first came to the company, all the things that they kind of brought us were things that the other artists had done already.
And they wanted
and
you to cover?
And it was like hand-me-down stuff. You know, I said, don't we want our own music? You know, that kind of thing. And I remember our very first release from Motown was Everybody Needs Love. Well, the Temptations had worn that out already. You know, I mean, it was a big hit for them. So we had our job cut out for us just to even get any recognition on it, because songs start to belong to people after a while. You know, I mean, a cover, and they're doing a lot of it now, if you've noticed. They're covering everything. I think it's a lack of music, you know, that they're looking for, you know? But I always felt about a cover. I have so much respect for the people that I love that it would be very difficult to do a cover.
I have to say that you do a really terrific version of a Boys to Men song.
Oh,
on your
thank
record.
You. Thank you. And that happened the same way as every other, I guess, cover song that I've ever done. I never set out to do a cover. I was doing Help Me Make It Through the Night in my show. And Motown comes up, right? We want that. Right. So, no, this is just for the show, because I get to do a solo portion in the show even when I was with the Pimps. And so they kept on. We got Help Me Make It Through the Night. The same thing with The Way We Were. The same thing with I Will Survive. The same thing. I never set out to cover these songs. The record companies just would always want to come and record those things that I do.
So do you feel that your sound or the group's choreography or your image changed much during the Motown years?
Not really. If anything, we got better. And I say this, and I don't mean to offend any of the Temptation fans or lovers out there tonight, but in actuality, the Pips started the fast step, the steps that the Temptations became so known for. The Pips were the first to do that. But the Temptations got the first national recording recognition, so they became known for those fast steps. So on a larger scale, so it started being attributed to them, but in actuality, they used to stand in the wings and watch every move the Pips made. You know, I'm serious.
I believe it.
So
I bet that there isn't a person in the house tonight who hasn't had the fantasy of singing with the Pips behind
them. Yes! You'd get the best. It's quite an experience, I tell you. It's quite an experience.
Now, you are, as I mentioned before, maybe the only group that was with Motown that had hits before Motown and after Motown.
You know, I heard you say that in the intro.
Is that not right?
Yes, but I never thought about it. I never thought about that. And it's real. It's the truth. Since 61, that particular song was also the one we heard, Every Beat of My Heart, was also a very phenomenal record because it ended up on the charts with the number 2 and the number 3 position, the same record, same group. First time in history that ever happened. So, yeah. So, we had music before, and our great record success, even as great or greater, came after we left Motown. So,
Midnight Train to Georgia.
Yes. Imagination.
You're the best thing.
You're the best thing that ever happened to me. It's really wondrous.
So, did you start choosing the material yourself after that? Was it good to have independence that you maybe didn't have when you were with Motown?
Well, toward the end of our contract with Motown, we had started to get a little more independence because I think they had just let us go, so to speak. So, and we were assigned to those producers and writers on their staff that weren't considered maybe, you know, the writers and producers, and they were missing so much talent. And Joe Porter happened to be one of those producers and writers. And that's where we got Neither One of Us Wants to Be the First to Say Goodbye and things like that, okay? And we worked with these promoters and producers, and we came up with some wonder, and we chose the material ourselves. And we found this great writer by the name of Jim Weatherly, who just fit us like a glove. And he was a country writer. And I'm a great lover of country music. Nobody tells a story, in my opinion, like a country singer or writer or producer. I mean, it's just so raw.
It's just raw. So what's the story with the Pips now? You haven't been singing together since what,
8 years.
Long?
When we came to the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame was the first time we'd actually, I mean, I've seen them since then, but it's the first time we've actually been out together socially as Gladys Knight and the Pips, you know? So it was quite an evening. We had so much fun. And the fact that we were together, and as you may have heard on the show that night, Edwards had a stroke in the last year and a half, so he's been in a wheelchair and using a walker and stuff. And when he heard about we had won this award, he actually got up and walked.
Wow.
I mean, he said, I'm going to this. yes, he made it, and it was so wonderful. And the sense of humor that these guys have and had in the years before, I think, was a lot about what got us through so many hard times, because we were always laughing and we were always telling jokes and things like that. And it was just a wonderful thing. And it shows how much, you know, humor can play a part in making the bad times not so bad.
Why did you split up?
Well, I had things that I wanted to do, and the Pips had things that they wanted to do, and we always planned our lives. We always planned our career. Even down to having babies. When I actually started my family after I got married, we had planned this when there were two other ladies for a very brief time, who was my sister and my cousin Eleanor. For a very brief time in the very beginning, we planned from that day. They wanted to go and get married and go to college, and they didn't want to hang out and be one of the boys. So that left me the only girl. So we decided at that time, say, okay, you're the only one left, and even though you're one of the boys, you're going to want to be a girl one day. So, so let's just figure this out now. So we decided right then that when I grew up and got married and started my family, if I wanted to quit the group, if I wanted to stop and go home, that I could, and they were going to continue on as an entity, especially if they had some notoriety going. And that's exactly the way it happened. We always said that we wanted to make a difference with our music. We wanted to make a difference as far as society goes. We didn't just want it to be about our music. We wanted to be about us as people as well. So, you know, we needed to show that force, that you can do things together if you really love each other and you really cherish each other. So,
oh, that's just what we did. We would go right along and make sure that we projected those things, and it worked out fine.
Gladys Knight, recorded in January at the Masonic Auditorium in San Francisco as part of the 15th anniversary celebration of City Arts and Lectures, which presents onstage lectures and interviews. The evening celebration was produced by Sidney Goldstein, associate producer Stephen Barclay, production coordinator Margaret Moose Pick. The interview was edited for Fresh Air by Joan Tui Westman. Special thanks to Bubba Knight. Coming up, world music critic Milo Miles on Al Gore's favorite dance. This is Fresh Air. Commenting on world music doesn't often involve a major pop hit. Our critic Milo Miles says one exception was this summer's most pervasive dance tune.
Folks always want a new sip of something light and lively in hot weather, and that applies to music as well as beverages. One particular concoction is the People's Choice in 1996. For those who didn't recognize that, I'm going to inform both of you that it's Macarena by a couple guys who call themselves Los Del Rio, and that it was the number one single on the Billboard Hot 100 for more than a month. Macarena comes with a hokey but distinctive dance you can learn in less time than it takes the song to play. This little jiggle is particularly popular at sports events where moves like, you know, the tango are never going to catch on. It may seem ridiculous to go on more about Los Del Rio and their hit. Wasn't it D.H. Lawrence who said certain grisly events remind us of a time before God was love? Well, Macarena is a throwback to the time before pop was art. Indeed, it's a wonderful example of a style I call international cheese. This type of tune can be produced by anyone of any age, sex, race, or homeland, so long as it convinces you that shaking your can for a few minutes will relieve all of life's problems. Like about a third of all number one hits, Macarena is just an insanely catchy bit of universal fluff. The core of Los Del Rio, Antonio Romero and Rafael Ruiz, are blatantly unhip middle-aged music vets who are considered rather washed up in their native Spain, until they conquered the world with Macarena, a song released in 1993. There seems to be no chart interest in anything by Los Del Rio except Macarena, but they have a CD called Calientito that is an absolute hoot. It's almost all up-tempo tracks, which is good because Romero and Ruiz no longer have the pipes for ballads, if they ever did. Calientito is utterly shameless, anything for a hook or a laugh or a sob. They even try what sounds like a Spanish transplant from a German beer hall.
Vente que yo te invito a la fiesta, vente conmigo a la fiesta de mi ciudad. Vente a conocer Andalucía y la feria de Sevilla, Manzanilla y a cantar. Vente a conocer los San Fermines, San Isidro y los Madriles, el Narcón.
Calientito does include both the original version of Macarena and the hit Bayside Boys remix, though the addition of the ditzy female talkover in English does make the tune more techno-disco generic. I like that it's sex-crazed in the manner of a Pedro Almodovar movie, a woman on the verge of the nervous giggles. Anyway, at first I thought the success of Macarena meant nothing for the state of world music, any more than hits by Ace of Base meant that Northern Europe had become the new hotspot for dance rock. But then I noticed a number of casual comparisons with Macarena and that old dud, the Lambada. This seemed off. The overhyped Lambada had become an instant joke, while Macarena had built for years by word of mouth and would never be considered a farce like the Lambada. Yet in some ways, the crash of the lightweight Lambada planted the seed for Macarena. It prepared people to accept a silly dance song in a foreign language. And the tragic murder of the singer Selena raised awareness of contemporary Spanish-speaking pop. As the temperature drops this fall, so will Macarena slide down the charts. But there's just a chance summer might become the regular season of international cheese.
Milo Miles is a music writer living in Cambridge. Fresh Air was produced today by Roberta Shirock. Technical direction from Audrey Bentham. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Alan Tu directed the show. I'm Cherie Gross.
I am not trying to do this.
When I dance, they call me Macarena. And the boys, they say que soy buena. They all want me, they can't have me. So they all come and dance beside me. Move with me, chant with me. And if you're good, I'll take you home with me.
Hala tu cuerpo, alegría, Macarena. Que tu cuerpo es pa' dar la alegría y cosas buenas. Hala tu cuerpo, alegría, Macarena. Macarena. Hala tu cuerpo, alegría, Macarena. Que tu cuerpo es pa' dar la alegría y cosas buenas. Hala tu cuerpo, alegría, Macarena. Macarena.
Now don't you worry about my boyfriend. The boy whose name is Vitorino. I don't want him, couldn't stand him.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and from Living Language, publishers of foreign language instruction programs for over 50 years, books, audio tapes, and now CD-ROM speech recognition technology. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, what it was like to be a centrist in the Reagan Revolution. We'll hear from Richard Darman. After serving in the Reagan administration, he was President Bush's budget director. Darman helped convince Bush to break his pledge and raise taxes. We'll ask Darman about tax promises in the current campaign. I'm Cherie Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.